It's very nice to be back in Adelaide, and it's very nice to be speaking to CEDA, so thank you very much all for having me. Let me hop into it. The Nobel Prize-winning physicist Niels Bohr said this: prediction is very difficult, especially if it's about the future. And I can't disagree with a Nobel Prize winner. But I'm going to have a go anyway, and I'm going to try to talk about seven aspects of the global outlook as I see them. I can't talk about everything, and I'm happy in the Q&A period to come back and talk about the things that I leave. But let me talk about seven aspects of our international environment. First of all, let me start with John Howard versus Barack Obama. I cannot go past the big bout, I'm afraid. It's very rare for Australian Prime Ministers to lead the news in the United States, so I need to talk about this a little bit. Talk about defying the zeitgeist. In the space of a single week, Prime Minister Howard queried the link between carbon emissions and climate change, and then he dissed the leading American political phenomenon, Barack Obama. In response to Senator Obama's call for troops to be withdrawn from Iraq by March 2008, Mr. Howard said this: if I were running Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I would put a circle around March 2008 and pray as many times as possible for a victory not only for Obama, but also for the Democrats. Now, there's a saying in diplomacy that words are bullets. But in the context of a highly charged presidential campaign, these words were more like improvised explosive devices. I think it's wise for political leaders to maintain a civil tone with potential and sitting heads of state of allied nations. And just as I thought it was ill-advised for Mark Latham to describe President Bush as the most incompetent and dangerous president in living memory, I think these particular words were impolitic. Now, we shouldn't exaggerate the damage that's been done by Mr. Howard's loose language. In fact, one of the common criticisms of current Australian foreign policy is that we are too circumspect in putting our views over to Washington. And I think that our consistent support for the war in Iraq entitles Australian leaders to speak their mind on that question. But I do think that this spat is developing in two troubling ways that I want to say to you this morning. Firstly, the tenor of Mr. Howard's comments, in my opinion, may have undercut Australia's influence with the Democrats. Last year, murmurs were already beginning in Washington that some congressional Democrats were getting uncomfortable with the unprecedented intimacy between Mr. Howard and President Bush. And this will only heighten that perception. One Democrat said, for example, "Given that Mr. Howard and President Bush have been lockstep from day one on this war in Iraq, we don't care what he says." The problem is, we want Democrats to care what Australian leaders say. Democrats control both houses of Congress, and there's a very reasonable chance they will soon occupy the White House too. We need to influence Democratic thinking on a whole range of issues, including Sino-US relations, the disposition of US forces in Asia, even mundane things like the marketing of Australian wheat. And I think while Mr. Howard has very adroitly cultivated the Bush administration, we need to start thinking about the next administration, which may well be run by an anti-war Democrat who has no special feelings about our participation in Iraq and is more interested in renewing ties with disillusioned European allies. Even more disturbing, though, than that element was Senator Obama's deadly response. I mean, talk about talent. This response cut through on the Iraq debate in a way that Labor and the media have been unable to do for 4 years. He compared the 1,400 personnel Australia has deployed in and near Iraq with America's deployment of roughly 100 times that number. And he said, if Mr. Howard wants to fight the good fight in Iraq, I suggest that he calls up another 20,000 Australians and sends them to Iraq. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of empty rhetoric. Now, that drew blood because it highlighted the gap between the government's extensive commentary on the importance of the struggle in Iraq versus the scale of our actual deployment there. That's something the Bush administration has been very polite about, but it seems that Democrats may not be so charitable. And I think it's quite disturbing that as a result of that intervention, we now have a serious candidate for the presidency making light of a dangerous deployment that we have undertaken largely for alliance management reasons, and even implying that Australia is not living up to its responsibilities. Let me finish on this point. Senator Obama said this: "It's flattering that one of George Bush's allies on the other side of the world started attacking me the day after I announced." But Australia is not an ally of George Bush. We're an ally of the United States. And that is a critical distinction, and one that is consistent with both sensible statecraft and Australian public opinion, and one we should be very careful to maintain. So in terms of predictions for 2007, I predict that Mr Howard does not try to re-enter the US presidential campaign, because this time didn't work so well. But I also predict, and I hope, that Australian political leaders are more careful about this, because the alliance with the United States, in my opinion, is a huge asset for us, an important part of our national security infrastructure. And there are different ways, but it's not indestructible, and there are different ways you can damage it. You can damage it by not speaking up to the Americans and by criticising them in an intemperate way. And we have to be careful that we don't fall into both categories at once. So that was Howard and Obama. Secondly, let me talk a little bit about US politics. Now, 2007 was not supposed to be an election year. That was meant to be 2008. But because this is the most open presidential race since 1928, the first time in 80 years that neither a sitting president nor vice president has been a candidate for president, the campaigning has started extremely early. Senator Hillary Clinton declared her candidacy last month, that is 22 months prior to the general election. By contrast, in 1992, her husband Bill declared his candidacy only 13 months prior to the poll. Now, the primaries don't begin until January next year. We've got a full year of debates and rhetoric and all that sort of stuff before anyone actually gets to vote on who's going to represent the Democrats and the Republicans. So I'm not going to chance my arm now on who's going to win those primaries, but let me make a couple of comments. On the Democratic side, Hillary is clearly the front runner. She is a formidable person. She controls the party organisation largely. She has institutional support she can fall back on if she stumbles at an early hurdle. She has basically been running for president for 6 years, and we know that her husband was a successful president for 8 years. So she is the front runner. I myself am an Obama fan. He's attractive, he's comfortable in his own skin, he can give a decent speech, he can even write one. I wonder in his heart if Bill Clinton does not see Senator Obama as his natural successor rather than Senator Clinton. On the Republican side, I like both McCain and Giuliani. I think they're running neck and neck both in the polls and in their respective strengths and weaknesses. So that's at the primary level. What about in the general election? Well, you'll hear all the commentators over the next year give you all the data about what determines who wins the presidential election, the economics of it, which Saul might touch on, the demographics, the class issues, the geography, the soccer mums, all national security, all the rest of it. I say to you this: when you think about the general election, forget all that stuff. Let me give you the fully loved rule about who wins general elections. The more likeable, comfortable, natural candidate in the general election always wins. That's why President Bush, who's a comfortable, easygoing kind of guy, beat the stiff patrician Senator Kerry in 2004. That's why the natural Bush beat the stiff Al Gore in 2000. That's why Clinton beat Dole in 96, why Clinton beat Bush in 1992. That's certainly why George H.W. Bush beat Dukakis in 1988. It's why Reagan beat Mondale and Carter. It's why Carter beat Ford. For the last 30 years, that rule holds true. It stops, unfortunately, at Richard Nixon, who was the least likable fellow imaginable, but he won two elections. But let me just leave that fully loved rule in your mind as you approach the general election. And let me put one other thing in your mind, that what would happen in the presidential election if there's another attack on the US homeland? I think that's the wild card that we have to consider. And in those circumstances, you would have to think that both Rudy Giuliani and Senator McCain have particular strengths that would trump most Democratic candidates. Thirdly, let me talk about US foreign policy. In 2004, I argued that US foreign policy would moderate. At that point, you remember President Bush had just won his second term. Everybody was saying Bush 2 is going to be more like Bush, just like Bush 1, just as muscular and unilateral, but with the handbrake off because Colin Powell was out of the administration. I thought he would become more moderate, not because he'd changed his mind, but because the growing problems in Iraq would limit his freedom to move. And I think that's turned out to be the case. Diplomacy has been the comeback concept over the last 3 years. The North Korean announcement overnight is only the latest evidence of the new importance and premium that the United States is putting on traditional foreign policy tools. The recent ousting of both Don Rumsfeld and John Bolton are also consistent with that. On the other hand, I think that President Bush's decision to surge the troops in Iraq shows he remains an instinct-driven politician. In the next year, I think this moderation in US foreign policy is likely to continue, particularly if the North Korean issue agreement is seen to be a success. The serious constraints on Bush's ability to move remain: military overstretch, horrible opinion poll ratings, a Democratic Congress, and so on. I do not think, therefore, that the United States will use force in the next year to interrupt the Iranian nuclear program. I think President Bush would have to do it over the advice of his Secretary of State, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, his new Defence Secretary, who said that it should be an absolute last resort, both houses of Congress and public opinion. That's leaving aside the unpredictability of the consequences for Iran, the Middle East, and the United States. The caveat is this. I mean, it's a very complex issue, and if people are interested in Iran, we can talk about it a bit later. But let me give you one caveat. If the surge in Iraq were to quieten the insurgency in the short term, because I don't think it has any chance in the long term, I think Iraq is a done deal. It was a huge mistake for US foreign policy, and that's now almost a total consensus in the international relations and security communities. But if the surge were to quieten the insurgency in the short term, if the militias and the insurgents were to adopt the military strategy that has the technical name run away, live to fight another day, while the surge is ongoing, you may see an increase in President Bush's freedom to move, and rather than a pause, rather than using that pause to draw down the troops in Iraq, you may get more faith-based foreign policy from the White House. And if that coincided with real provocation from Tehran, then all bets may be off. But I still think it's highly unlikely they will use force. My fourth point is on Europe. I think this year we will see very significant changes of tone in two major European countries. First of all, in Britain, Chancellor Gordon Brown will almost certainly take over from Prime Minister Tony Blair in mid-2007. What will we see from Gordon Brown? On style, I think we will see a different style. We will see less Hollywood. Hopefully we will see an end to the practice of British Prime Ministers holidaying with the Bee Gees in Miami. On substance, of course you would expect to see a lot of continuity, because Gordon Brown has been not only Chancellor for the last decade or so, but a highly successful Chancellor and a dominant Chancellor in economic policy. But like all new politicians, he will also want some product differentiation. So I think we will see from Mr. Brown some distancing from the Bush administration and from Iraq, and a focus on two agendas that he can make his own. First of all, climate change, and secondly, poverty reduction in Africa, especially a campaign for universal free primary education. In France, there are presidential elections scheduled for April-May. And power will pass almost certainly from Jacques Chirac to Nicolas Sarkozy or Ségolène Royal. Now, French presidential elections are notoriously difficult to predict. Many of you remember the last presidential election when Lionel Jospin ran third, and the runoff election was between Monsieur Le Pen and Monsieur Chirac. So they're very hard to predict. At this stage, Sarkozy certainly is ahead of Royal, who's run a deeply unimpressive campaign with gaffes on foreign policy, on Quebec, on Corsica, on Israel, on China, and a number of other issues. But I think that whoever wins, we can say this, we will see a change in the insiderdom that has dominated French politics. Only two men have lived in the Élysée Palace in the past quarter of a century. Two presidents in a quarter of a century. And both Sarkozy and Royal are insiders in very different ways, but they are new characters, and I think both of them would bring not only a new style, but quite possibly a new substance to the management of France. The bad news is for everybody that in Europe there's no election in Kazakhstan this year, so Borat's political career, I'm afraid, will remain on hold. Fifthly, I want to talk briefly about China and about China's global political strategy. China's rising confidence, its diplomatic dexterity, and its military capability would, if plotted on a chart, produce a growth curve that is every bit as impressive as the country's recent economic performance. Analysts, particularly in Australia, rightfully focus on China's clout in Southeast Asia and in Northeast Asia, and its new influence with US treaty allies such as Australia and South Korea. But we also need to look more broadly at China's influence in resource-rich countries in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East. And I want to talk to you just for a minute or two about one aspect of this that people usually don't think about, but it's pretty important, and that's China's new influence at the United Nations. China has quickened the pace of its interactions with the world body, and it has outperformed the United States in New York over the last 5 years. But I think it's now facing a new test to step up and assume the responsibilities that are incumbent upon a global power. And I think that those two points about Chinese performance, but the new test that China faces, apply more broadly than the United Nations. But let me start with the UN. Let me trace China's new approach to the UN in three issues: the Security Council, peacekeeping, and personnel. First of all, in the Council, historically China was a passive, defensive Security Council member. It rarely sought to shape the agenda. It abstained on most sensitive issues. These days, China's representatives behave confidently in the Security Council chamber and volubly before the media. China is increasingly willing to take the lead on issues and behave more like a normal great power. And it is being treated as such by other council members, including the United States. Secondly, on peacekeeping, China used to say that peacekeeping was an imperialist plot. It used to say that it trespassed too much on national sovereignty, that this was all to do with the United States' domination of the international system. China now deploys, how's this for a killer fact? China now deploys more peacekeeping personnel, military and civilian, around the world than any other permanent member of the Security Council. More than the United States, more than Britain, more than France, much more than Russia. Thirdly, in terms of the people that China deploys, a friend of mine used to say, said to me that China used to take a prophylactic approach to the people it deployed to New York, both as officials in the UN Secretariat and as ambassadors and national diplomats. That is, it would send people over there and seek to shield them from influence, protect them from other countries so that their Marxist-Leninist purity wasn't damaged. Now they take the opposite approach. They send some of the best diplomats in New York and they spend their time trying to spread their influence. Now, why is this important? Why am I telling you about this? Because it's emblematic of the sea change in China's global strategy, that it is far more confident, far more dexterous, far more skillful at the global level as well as the regional level. But here's the point, I think. There are limits to China's conversion. Its representatives are more skillful and confident in the way that they transact their business in New York and all around the world, but they have not, in my opinion, internalised all the responsibilities of a great power. Sometimes China pursues its narrowly drawn interests on energy security, for example, or the supposedly existential struggle with Taiwan, with an uncompromising resolve that would be described as amoral belligerence if it were attempted by the United States. And if China really wants to be perceived as a responsible stakeholder, as it always tells us that it does, then I argue it must conceive of its interests more broadly than it has in the past and help to nurture the international system that it aspires to lead. There are many examples of this, but one of them, for example, is the Darfur issue in Sudan, where China has consistently extended political protection to Khartoum in return for preferential access to oil. China has escaped scrutiny on these kinds of issues in the past, in particular in the last 5 years, when the United States has run such a muscular, unilateral, unpopular foreign policy, and when it's been represented in New York by a man, Mr. Bolton, who famously said that the UN would be unaffected if it lost 10 stories off the Secretariat building. China took the opportunity, while the United States stepped back from global politics, China took the opportunity to step up. But now that they have stepped up, now that they've stepped into the light, they are going to get a lot more scrutiny. In other words, they are playing a strong hand well at the moment. But I predict that to stay competitive in the game over the long term, China is going to have to alter its tactics again, because with great power comes great responsibility. Sixth, let me make a deeply substantial and important point. My sixth prediction for 2007 is that celebrities will continue to take over the world of international relations. Now, famous people have always dabbled in good deeds, but that trend is accelerating in tandem with our galloping fetishisation of celebrity. First-class airport lounges are now crowded with rock star diplomats, spokesmodels, and actors without borders. Let me give you some examples. Angelina Jolie, It Girl and Goodwill Ambassador for the UNHCR, tours camps in Pakistan with Brad Pitt. UNICEF's celebrity supporters include David Beckham, Ricky Martin and Robbie Williams, while the UN Food and Agricultural Organization has Ronan Keating, the boy band idol. A lot of gravitas these people bring, isn't it? Fashion designers have not been forgotten. Giorgio Armani is associated with UNHCR and Pierre Cardin with UNESCO. The UN Population Fund has no less than 5 former Miss Universes in its stable of goodwill ambassadors. Michael Douglas is a UN messenger for peace, speaking publicly on the proliferation of small arms, a topic on which he is presumably expert given the number of films in which he's wielded them. Supermodels, Spice Girls, James Bonds and Charlie's Angels all represent various UN organisations and international NGOs. Now, the argument for celebrity activism, which my wife occasionally gives me, is that it provides exposure to important issues that would otherwise be overlooked by the media in favour of trivial stories such as celebrity romances. And this was probably true a decade or two ago before we were inured to the phenomenon. And there are a few very effective celebrity diplomats, I would acknowledge, for whom it remains the case today. But for the most part, the media lights fall more on the celebrities themselves than on the people whose condition demands urgent illumination. And I think that the explosion of celebrity activists, which unfortunately will continue this year, is damaging the causes and institutions they seek to promote for 3 reasons. First of all, their lack of expertise opens up the movements they represent to ridicule by association. With some honourable exceptions, these people know nothing on the subjects on which they hold forth, except that which is in the talking points put in front of them, and that's not a good look. Secondly, the awkward lifestyle gap that yawns between the rescuers and the rescued undercuts the moral seriousness of the enterprise and gives it an exploitative feel. Putting an end to extreme poverty, in my opinion, requires, in fact, the opposite of celebrity worship, namely that the world turn away from the rich and the famous and the beautiful towards the poor and the invisible and the unfortunate. Third, attaching your organisation's brands to a celebrity's fortunes can be hazardous because celebrities' lives tend to be unpredictable. You remember when Kate Moss was caught allegedly snorting cocaine by the British tabloids, all her sponsors and all the fashion outfits for which she was a clothes horse had to scurry away. Well, the same thing happens for NGOs. It happened when Harry Belafonte recently called President Bush the greatest terrorist in the world. And the best example occurred just last month. You may have read about this in the papers, in the Tizer, when Ralph Fiennes followed a Qantas hostie into the toilet on a flight to Mumbai. And it turns out, why was he going to India? It turns out he was on his way to India to promote safe sex as a way of beating HIV/AIDS. So, I mean, my argument is there is an unanswerable moral case for doing things about these causes. We don't need false idols to put the case for us. Unfortunately, they will continue to do so. Finally, let me close on my seventh prediction for 2007. I have a prediction not about foreign policy, but about the foreign policy commentariat, the people we read in the pages of our newspapers. I predict the commentators on foreign policy, I don't know if this is the case in relation to economic policy as well, Saul, I'll leave you to comment on that, but I predict that foreign policy commentators will continue to be very much in favour of accountability for policymakers, not so much in favour of accountability for pundits. In my opinion, as I mentioned a second ago, the balance sheet on the war in Iraq is now clear. It was a dreadful mistake. And it was a dreadful mistake not only for the people of Iraq, but even more importantly for us, for our great ally, the United States, on whom we depend for many, many public goods. I think we now need an exercise in due diligence on the part of the commentators who got their analysis so wrong. I would like to see some honest self-examination, a bit of rigour, a sense of responsibility for positions taken on both sides, on the pro-war and the anti-war side, but particularly among the supporters of the war because it's gone so badly. Now, in the United States, which has a much richer intellectual culture, the hawks on the Iraq war have been much better at this. They have taken themselves to task. They've gone back and looked at it and said, this is what I got right, this is what I got wrong, and they've either changed their position on the merits of going to war or they've stuck with their guns, but they've gone through the process. But we have not got that in Australia, and I don't think we will get it this year, unfortunately. I think what we'll get is more of what we're getting at the moment, which is the Baghdad shuffle. That is, people saying the war was right in principle, but it was wrong in execution. That is, this is Bush's fault, or Rumsfeld's fault, or Wolfowitz's fault, or the Iraqis' fault, but it's not my fault. These commentators will move seamlessly and shamelessly onto the next foreign policy issue on which we are meant to listen to them, as though the Iraq war had nothing to do with them. And they will tell us that harping on about the decision to go to war is so yesterday, and it's not at all relevant to the challenges we face. Well, I disagree. It's highly relevant. Because if we don't do this, if we don't undergo the same exercise of due diligence, the same sense of responsibility that all the business leaders in this room have to do every year when they face up to their board or to their shareholders, then we won't know whether our intellectual infrastructure is up to the task the next time a system-altering foreign policy decision faces us. My prediction is, unfortunately, we won't get it. Thank you very much.